Resignation leads to the understanding that even in resigning, you can't resign. It isn't as if someone were saying, you must play this game, and you felt yourself under some sort of compulsion. It's rather discovering that the game is what there is. And to if you got out of it, would be to be nowhere. You don't have to play. This is the point. I'm going to repeat this because this is crucial. It isn't that you have to play, because that would make you feel a victim of some process beyond yourself that was compelling you. It is that the playing is you. And nobody is shoving you around. Because you and the universe, which seems to constrain you, are not two things. If you play the game that you are only here, then you'll feel pushed around. But when, through trying to resign from either pushing around or being pushed around, you discover that it can't be done, you then become very much aware there is no point getting away from anything. Where is a way? And so it said, a true Zen monk has a mountain hermitage in any place that he stands on. So let's have intermission, shall we?
Thus far, we have discussed two of the four attitudes to the human predicament, characteristic of religions and methods of spiritual development, the attitudes of repentance and of resignation. Now let me repeat that the premise of this whole discussion, the first premise, is that existence is a game in all senses of that word, the best senses and the worst senses. That it's a pattern of dancing, the principle of which is now you see it, now you don't, or hide and seek, or lost and found. And that we, as members of Western culture in the 20th century, inherit a way of playing this game, wherein we pretend that we are each one of us an isolated individual who comes into the world as a stranger. We do not know, in the ordinary course of events, that that is not true, and that each one of us is a way in which the whole fullness of ultimate reality pretends it gets lost. In an individual life situation, and endures the adventures of pain and death, and endures all the critical efforts and decisions connected with practical and moral problems. The fact that this is the case is, of course, the content of certain kinds of experience which are extraordinary. That means simply not necessarily rare, but outside the usual order of things. The types of experience we call cosmic consciousness, mystical vision, and so on, wherein sometimes as the result of following a yoga, but sometimes simply as a consequence of a spontaneous change of gears, you might almost call it, inside the brain, or some anomaly of switching, we get let into the secret. And in such a moment, a person feels that that scales had dropped from his eyes and that he was awakened to the true state of affairs. That we do not know this to be the case in the ordinary way is because we are, you could say in a certain sense of the word, hypnotized. In the sense of the word that is applicable to the technique of a stage magician, almost all stage magic consists in misdirection of attention. So that the magician makes you watch something that will distract your attention from the trick he's going to pull on you. And we are almost all distracted in just such a way. Because we have so specialized in the powers and properties of conscious attention to things that we have identified our very selves with that faculty alone. We are therefore unaware of a much more inclusive and diffused kind of awareness which underlies the possibility of conscious attention and which characterizes every single nerve end in our bodies. We screen out, that is to say, we pay no attention to most of the information, or to use electronic terms, input that our organism receives. It is possible, however, to, as I say, slip switches so that we become aware of the input. I won't say of the total input, because that would be shattering. But we become aware of a great deal more than we ordinarily notice. And it is in those moments that the experiences of cosmic consciousness occur. Because it is in those moments that we become aware of the fact that what is inside your skin goes together with what is outside your skin in just the same way as your head go together with your feet. The two, obviously, it's physically impossible for your inside organs to exist apart from the outside universe. I mean, you just simply wouldn't have any air to breathe, for one thing. The simplest possible case of it. But it's far more complexly related than that. And the going together of these two worlds constitutes a unified field of process, of being, and we are not ordinarily aware of it because of the trick, the game of pretending that we are the inside of the skin only. So then, under the conditions of this game, and I'm not saying it's a bad game, that we shouldn't play this game. I'm only pointing out that it is a game. And that it sets up, in other words, as all games sets up, it sets up some formal rules. But these formal rules of a game should not be identified with the laws of nature or with the state of affairs of reality. The rules of games are conventions. That is to say, agreements about how we are going to carry out a certain operation, like the rules of dancing a waltz are game rules. So also are the rules of marriage, of political elections, of how we measure time and distance, and all such things. They are conventions. And convention is a word that translates exactly one of the meanings of the Sanskrit term maya, which is the all-inclusive word that the Hindus and Buddhists use for the world illusion. It is therefore a convention to think of nature as divided into separate things and separate events. That is a convention that corresponds exactly to the mathematical operation of the calculus, whereby a curve is measured by pretending that it is a discontinuous series of points or of tiny, tiny straight lines. It isn't so. The curve is continuous. But by pretending that it could be a series of point instants, we can count them, work out their positions in reference to some kind of standard scale, and so get a measurement of the curve. Now, just as one does that in mathematics, so in everyday life, we count every human organism as a thing unit, and we count all kinds of things as a thing unit, but sometimes a child will surprise you by asking you for the name of something which you've never thought of as a thing. We don't, for example, have a word which specifies the inside of curved surfaces, like the inside of a pot or the inside of a pipe or the inside of a tin can. We don't have a word that specifies dry space or a dry surface. Now, other languages have words for those, because to those peoples, for some reason or other, this concept is important. Aztec language has one word which covers rain, ice, hail, snow, whereas the Eskimos have five words to differentiate different kinds of snow alone. So a child will often ask about something and say, "What is that?" And the parent is not clear as to what that signifies. And it is because, you see, things and events are the units of experience, and they are those parts of experience that we notice. And when you notice something, you apply to it a notation. You notice by making notations. And notations are words, numbers,
and such symbols as musical notes or algebraical signs or astronomical symbols or whatever. It is a way of dividing up the world so as to be able to discuss it with each other and so to control our environment. But don't be deceived by noticing and notation. The world in which we live is not really divided. It's like taking a sieve and passing it through water. The wires, of course, cleave the water, but the water doesn't stay neatly sliced into square lengths, you see, as if it were something like bean curd. The water closes again. And so in the same way, although the intellect constantly slices the world into units, the world won't be sliced. That does not mean that the real state of the world is something like bean curd or junket, completely formless. It means that the world is full of just those very forms that we see, but it's full of a lot more forms than we see. First of all, the wave band upon which our senses are responsive to the electrical goings-on outside our skins is quite narrow. And if we had a wider range of sensitivity, let's imagine that we had some additional sense organs that were as different from the five that we have as sight is different from hearing. Then we should be aware of all kinds of connections and phenomena that we don't see in the ordinary way. But even with without the addition of extra senses of that kind, it is possible to increase human awareness so that we can see all kinds of things that we ordinarily ignore. The simplest example of this is that when we look at other people's faces, we see the human face in a formalized way. We see faces as painters and beauticians have taught us to see them. There are many characteristics of the human face that we block. Now, supposing you are a so-called white Caucasian, you are supposed to have, you see, a vaguely pinkish, smooth skin. Well, you don't have anything of the kind. You have a highly differentiated, many-colored, blotchy skin. Only if you put on heavy makeup, like a pancake makeup, of course, you reduce the color variations. But even then, your face moves constantly through an interplay of lights that are altering all the time. And we choose, unless you are a painter or a photographer who is trained to look at these details, you ordinarily ignore them altogether. Our faces have all kinds of hairs on them, and pimples, and little funny jiggles, and it's all there. Only we don't consider that those details are significant details, and so we screen them out of everyday consciousness. So this maya, this calculus of dividing up reality into units which are presumed to be disconnected but somehow related to each other in more or less the same way as billiard balls that interact by banging each other around becomes the commonsensical view of the world and is just a convention and nothing more. Now, in that circumstance, in the circumstance of the person, the human being, feeling lonely and feeling that he confronts an alien world, one of the possible tactics and the games that he can play is the highly aggressive game of dominating the environment by the power of his will. And this game is what I've indicated here by the word rebellion. Now, I'm using that word in a very loose and inclusive sense to cover not only formal rebellion, that is to say, the criminal way of life, but also even official rebellion. That is to say, a U.S. Marine sergeant might represent in some way an official rebel. Since his attitude, his whole way of life, is based on guts and the exaltation of the gutsy attitude to things, of the strong arm, of muscle, of brawn as against brain. And you can carry this attitude to such an extreme that it can become a way of realization, just in the same way as these others, repentance, resignation, and as we shall see, reincarnation. In a certain sense, Jean Genet is an example of the rebel, of the Sartre has put forward the view that Genet is a holy criminal. And this idea has had great popularity in modern times in France, and is part of the mystique of criminal young people in the United States. And it has to be understood, because otherwise one doesn't really deal with it. To be, in other words, delivered from the egocentric predicament by carrying egocentricity to its extreme. Now, first of all, the idea that we are egos, although I've described it as a convention and as something that is not fundamentally so, nevertheless, the idea that we are egos does exist. There was a faith healer of Deal who said, although pain is not real, when the point of a pin goes into my skin, I dislike what I fancy I feel. But you see, the fancy is there. And in the same way, the imagination, the illusion, the maya that we are separate egos, is something that does exist. And that fact of fancying so is not a bad thing. It is a form of game. If you would imagine life as a dance, choreographic pattern, you might say that the imagination of being an ego is a very far out curlicue You know how people do frond designs, where you get a frond like this, and another one here, and so, and then say, well, now, come on, let's go. Do this, smaller ones, like this, so, so. See, drawing these tendrils on a vine, and then itty-bitty tendrils come out of the others. See? And they make it more complicated and more interesting. And so in that way, the development of the sensation of the ego is a very far out curlicue. On the extremities of life. So the fact that you and I imagine we are egos is the same sort of thing as you will observe in any complex pattern of ferns or crystals or surface tensions in foam or anything like that. It is very, very natural. And so there is then a legitimate way of following this fancy through to its logical conclusion. The yoga of egocentricity. Now, this is a very difficult yoga for many people to follow, because we've been brought up so as not to have the courage of our convictions about it. To be a consistent egotist, perhaps Nietzsche was a great exemplar of this philosophy. To be a consistent egotist requires tremendous nerve, because everybody is trying to put you down and say to you, you should be unselfish. You should cooperate with us. And that requires doing things that you may not like to do, but it is for the common good that you should do these things. But the difficulty about all this is, I'm talking at a quite superficial level of this descent. I'm talking about here. When people pretend to be unselfish and cooperative, they confuse others horribly. If you give somebody else the impression that you're going to be their loyal friend and you're going to really knock yourself out for them, and they rely on you to do that, and then you let them down because that wasn't really what you meant to do, you create a great deal of trouble. So in marriage, if you vow to be faithful and constant to some girl in a moment of intense passion, and then after a while your affections cool off, and you've led her to believe that you will always be reliable and faithful, there's an awful crash coming. So it's terribly important to be emotionally honest. It's very difficult because we don't always know what our emotions are. But to say to someone that I will love you forever and ever is a very, very serious dishonesty and deception. So in the same way, to give the impression to all those around you in your society, your community, that you will put the community before yourself and can be relied upon to do this, is a dangerous thing to do. You may have the fullest intention of carrying this out, but I find in practical relationships that I am much more comfortable with people who tell me frankly what their feelings are. In other words, if I'm not welcome because they've got other business to do and they're all tied up with things, it's much better that a person should say, I'm sorry, but I don't feel inclined to see anybody right now. I'm busy and so on. Then I can rely upon that person that when they tell me you are welcome, that I really am. One of my best friends is a woman who is totally frank. And if she, even if for purely irrational reasons, she doesn't want to come along with something or do something, she just says, I don't feel like it. And so we understand each other perfectly. Everybody understands her. Because then they know when she says, please come, that she really means it. So, a proper egocentricity, if you feel like an ego, you see, is essential to good human relations. And to be guided by your real wishes as far as you can make them out and know what they are, is on the whole a safer bet in human relations than to be guided by abstract principles. Now, the abstract principles are all very well, and we should know what an ideal pattern of human behavior might be. One has to keep, as it were, one's eye on that to see if you like it. You see, the game of existence is not very simple. If I could say, you know, rely entirely on your feelings, act on impulse, never do anything except what you would really want to do, it isn't. That would be oversimplification. Because among the things that most of us really want to do, there is a certain concession we would like to make to an ideal pattern. So sometimes when a person does do something which is an act of self-sacrifice, or described as such, it really is something he wants to do. Somebody gives away somebody some money, he doesn't do it because this is a sacrifice and in a masochistic spirit, but because, good heavens, I would really like to see what would happen when this guy gets the money. What fun to see this enterprise start, even if I don't get anything back from it. I'll have the entertainment. So, an ideal pattern of how human relations might be is always something to be worked out, thought about, and kept in mind. For we are always, it's always possible we might want it that way. But basically, to do what you really want to do is a more secure gamble than pretending all the time about a lot of oughts and shoulds. A friend of mine who was a very brilliant mathematician once told a story that in the beginning of the ages, God was making up a dictionary of all the words that would be used in language. And one day he visited the Archangel Gabriel
and they left the dictionary in the taxi. And while he was in with talking to Gabriel, the devil got into the taxi and wrote into the dictionary two words, ought and should. Well, as a result, then, of pretenses, of not being honest about what we want, untold confusion arises. You know the proverb, be very careful of what you desire, you may get it. We live in a culture where almost the whole economy depends upon the creation of artificial desires, upon giving you desires that you might never have had in the ordinary way, and therefore thinking that you want things that simply aren't wantable. A lot of people, for example, when they feel miserable, depressed, simply go out shopping. Because somehow purchasing something seems to be a fulfillment of life. I mean, I know a lot of wives whose husbands are engaged in business and leave them alone most of the day. Well, there's nothing to do, except they regularly go shopping. They shop every day, as if it was something you had to do every day, like having breakfast. And, of course, that keeps things buzzing and keeps the economy going. But it means that you misinterpret your own feelings. And so there's always, after a shopping spree, a sense of letdown. Same thing happens every Christmas day with children. You know, the toys are increasingly phony. They are a method of propitiating children. I was saying yesterday about the educational system as being a method of preventing children from growing up too fast so that they won't come on the labor market in one huge splodge. So in the same way, children who are not allowed to participate in human activities such as cooking and hunting and so on have to be given phony activities. Toy cooking stoves, dolls, dolls' houses, guns, anything but the real thing, so that they will be kept amused and kept out of the way. Because any real child, you know, likes to play with pots and pans and all the things that the adults use and are doing. But toys prevent them from doing that. Now then, what happens is that the children are given an immense artificial desire for toys. A toy shop seems paradise. But when on Christmas Day, the beautiful tree and all the tinsel and all the stuff and packages, wonderfully wrapped, you know, the wrappings are better than the contents. More beautiful. They get all these things out and the room is strewn with guns and buses and dolls and all that stuff. By 4 o'clock in the afternoon, they are screaming frantic. Because actually the whole thing was a terrible letdown. And that happens again and again. But that happens to the adults, you see. The adults are merely repeating for the children what they're doing. They're acquiring all this kind of pretentious junk. I'm thinking that's the answer, and it's a letdown.
because they didn't find out that they don't really want it, and they don't find out what they do really want. Because everybody has to pretend that it's good to work for what you don't want. So that's the initial difficulty. That is the mere guardian dog at the gate on this path. You see? But so, I mean, just simply an initial step here is to be honest with yourself and to be unashamedly egotistic. See, I like people who, supposing they have a certain accomplishment, don't be blushing violets about it, but say, I can do this. I know how to do it, and I do it well, and I can exact, therefore, a fair price for it. I feel happy with a person like that, especially if he's someone, say, like a doctor. I sure want to know that he's good at his job. And if he's confident about it like that and says, yes, I know what to do, then I have that essential faith in him, which everybody has to have in their doctor in order to be healed. But we say, the community says to a person who does that, you are immodest. You are too big for your boots. You've got a swelled head. Now, a person has a swelled head when his opinion of his accomplishments is excessive. But when a person's accomplishments are good, he ought to be proud of them and be delighted that he can do it so well. Everybody, if you can dance well, don't you love to do it? Are you a show-off? Yes, you are a show-off, you know, but beautiful. Show-off, please, we like to see it. This is part of the reason, too, why we all go around in drab colors. Mustn't show off. Mustn't be too conspicuous. Get a kind of a clergy look to you. You know, modest. Yes, I'm glad to see it. Yeah. Okay. Because, you see, people have thought in the past, if you show off, the enemy will notice you. So a chameleon disappears into its background and doesn't show off, so that the birds or whatever want to eat that chameleon won't notice it. But when you live in a reasonably protected community, as we do, we are still carrying over from a past all kinds of camouflage habits, which really aren't necessary anymore. You can branch out a little. It's extraordinary that our society doesn't really tolerate eccentricity, even though it was based on what it thought was rugged individualism. But you see, that's because we are half-hearted about individualism. And if you are going to go the way of the ego, you must go it thoroughly. That was true of all these ways. If you are going to chop off somebody's head, and that really is the decision, somehow or other it's necessary, you've got to do it with determination. For a half chopped off head is very bad. To use a blunt axe. This is the philosophy underlying Bushido, which is the Japanese philosophy of chivalry based on Zen, where they decided that if there are going to be soldiers And if there is going to be fighting at all, then it must be done supremely well. And if you're going to fight supremely well, you've got to have a sword like a razor. You know, a Japanese sword is literally a heavy razor. And you've got to know how to go on to have what we call follow-through. So the whole notion of Bushido swordsmanship is based on unhesitating going ahead. Going ahead. It's called in Chinese Mo Chir Chu, or going straight aheadness, which is an attitude of never pausing. If, for example, if you drive a car on the freeway here, you have to have Mo Chir Chu. You mustn't hesitate. It's true, even more true driving a car in Rome, where these Italian drivers are fast, but very subtle. And they're tremendously aware of each other, much more so than here. The worst drivers are in England. But in Rome, there's very fast-speed driving, but they're instantly responsive. And you just have to go ahead and get into the traffic and go! That's the only safety there is. If you hesitate and fiddle around and so on, you're done for. So this is the art of decapitation. With sudden, swift speed. If what you're going to do is wrong, do it well. As Luther put it, peccate fortiter. If you're going to sin, make it a good one. If you're going to make a mistake, make it a good one. But don't mimble-mamble and shuffle and, as they say in Zen, walk or stand as you will, but whatever you do, don't wobble. So that realization is about here. You know, we have the first one there. We're about here now. Now then, keep on going. When in the Divine Comedy, Dante, accompanied by Virgil as his guide, explore hell, they pass through a gate which says, "All hope abandon, you who enter here. You never, never can get out." That means you can't retrace your steps. There is a way out, however. But you have to go down to the bottom. And they finally come to the place where Satan himself is encased in ice, brooding over a huge, vast field of ice, and gnawing on Judas and Brutus and someone else, Cassius, the great traitors. There he is, utterly malignant. And every now and then his bat-like wings close together and open, close together and open. Now those wings are the symbol of the active door. The active door comes in all mythologies in some way or other, and it is the gate through which, in passing, you go through the critical moment of initiation. And to get through the active door, you've got to go without hesitation, because if you hesitate, you're too late. It crushes you. Jason, sailing the Argo, has to go through the Symplegades, the clashing rocks. Odysseus has to get between Scylla and Charybdis. One of the Arthurian legends, is it Sir Gawain and the Green Knight? I forget. But there's somebody who has to charge his horse across the drawbridge and into the portcullis. And just as he gets in, the portcullis crashes down and takes off the rear end of his horse. He's got it. All sorts of stories like that. So the wings of the devil, going this way, this way, this way, they have to get quickly through those wings, and they climb down the devil's back on this great tough fur that he has, great heavy hair. Then suddenly they get a strange sensation that they are no longer climbing down, but climbing up, because they've passed the midpoint of the earth. And then they come where they hear a stream flowing. And by following the sound of the stream, they find the secret passage which leads them out again to the vision of the stars. So what it means, all hope abandon ye who enter here, is you can't go back. You can only go on. And so in this thing, in this egocentric situation, once you're an ego, or think you are, there is no way out but on. Now you see what's happened here. The people who repented of being egos were trying to go back. And by trying very hard to go back, to relent, say, no, no, I should never have got into this, they found they couldn't go back and that they were phonies. The people who said, we resign from being egos, found they couldn't resign. Now we're getting a little bit warmer, aren't we? You found you couldn't go back, and so you've got to play the ego game to the limit. And so comes the point. When a person plays this to an extreme, he may be in a very odd situation. He may play it by being a real criminal and end up in the penitentiary. But he's going to end up in a situation which is symbolized by three great myths. One is the myth of the tar baby. The other of giant sticky hair, and the other the crucifixion. We found the crucifixion again, didn't we, when we went along this way. But you know, the tar baby is, you get stuck to it whenever you touch it. And giant sticky hair comes in the Jataka tales about what the Buddha in one of his previous incarnations attacked a certain giant whose hairs were sticky, and everything that hit him got stuck, and this giant used to eat the people of a certain village, and the prince came there one day and heard about it and said he would go and clobber the giant. So he went to the giant and he struck him with his left hand, and it got stuck. He struck him with his right hand, and that got stuck. He kicked him with his left foot, that got stuck. Kicked him with his right foot, and that got stuck. He then banged him with his head, and that got stuck. And the giant said, aha, now I'm going to eat you. And the prince said, that's all very well, but you will find if you eat me that inside my belly is a thunderbolt, and if you swallow that, it will blow you to pieces. So the giant released the prince and promised not to eat the villagers anymore. So when you follow your ego to the limit, you get stuck. You see? You find you're suddenly paralyzed in your effort to play against the world. But you realize that the reason for this is that in fighting the world, you're fighting yourself. You are like a person who picks up a dagger in each hand, and the left hand says to the right, I'll take you on. Let's fence. You ever tried it? It's fascinating. You know, be careful. But you can have this strange thing. And what happens is this. You meet a moment of total paralysis. Because each hand knows perfectly well what the other one's going to do. It just stalemate. So by following your ego to its most intense point, you reach stalemate in the same way, because suddenly the left hand discovers what the right hand's doing. And at that point you see, after all, I wasn't a separate ego. So let's have an intermission.
It's curious that in all the three approaches we've thus far discussed, the response of repentance, resignation, and rebellion, that there's an element of desperation in each one of them. Each one is an expression of conflict. Conflict between the human being sensing himself as a separate ego and the life situation in which he finds himself. Now remember that I pointed out that the situation of feeling yourself to be an ego is a kind of game. It is a pattern of life, a style of life, just in exactly the same way that a robin or an ant or a marigold is a style of life. It has a particular shape. It goes this way or it goes that way or whatever it is, you see? And so the human world in which we live out our egocentric adventures is a certain style of behavior, a certain kind of music, and so also are these three conflicting scenes. The fourth way, though, that we bring up now, I call reincarnation, simply because for mnemonic reasons, I was giving 4 R's instead of the usual 3 R's. And I don't mean reincarnation quite in the sense that it's ordinarily understood. I mean getting with life. And if this should by any chance involve reincarnation, that is to say the willingness to be manifested in this world and all its adventures again and again and again and again, yes, you can take it in that sense. But, you know, this attitude in the religions of the world is extremely rare. Most religions are against life, practically speaking. They turn back, as it were, to the Lord God and say, you made a mistake, either in creating the world or in allowing the snake in the garden. And what we really have to do is get out of it. The way of repentance says, God, you didn't make the mistake, we did. We're terribly sorry, but we'll try to do better next time. And we know we've offended most awfully against you, but I know you still love us, and
we really will do our best if you will help. The way of resignation tends to say that there wasn't some kind of original sin that man or an angel committed, but that the manifestation of the many out of the one is itself some kind of mistake in some way. And this game where, for example, all biological beings live by eating each other is a bad show. And we resign. If possible, we won't eat anything that screams too loud when it's killed. I asked R.H. Blythe, or my wife, I think, asked him, why are you a vegetarian? R.H. Blythe is a great British Zen man. And she said, don't you realize that it also hurts the plants to tear them up and so on? He said, yes, but they don't scream. But in the attitude of resignation, you see, there is still this conflict. Spirit against matter, the sense of the dualism of the soul incarcerated in the fleshly prison. In the attitude of rebellion, there is still even a very critical way expressed the sense of differentiation between the individual and the world. And our modern technological civilization, dedicated to the so-called conquest of nature, is a preeminent expression of that spirit. But as I pointed out to you, if you push it far enough, if you rebel or oppose the universe with sufficient will and vigor, you eventually reach an impasse which is just like fencing with yourself. You have two knives crossed, see? And you are going to dig one of them. I mean, if you don't want to do it so dangerously, you can do it with knitting pins or even with chopsticks. And have a fencing match with yourself so that one hand tries to hit the other and the other to defend itself. Well, you reach a stick point because both hands know in advance what the other one's going to do. And I use that as comparable to the situation which arises when you have opposed whatever it is that you want to oppose sufficiently enough to discover that what everything you defined as other turns out to be the same as you. Or to put it more exactly, I and not I turn out to be two poles of the same process. And it's the process rather than the poles that really constitutes you. The last word in metaphysics is, if you understand this, it's the whole secret. There is an inside for every outside and an outside for every inside. They go together, you see? When the inside moves, the outside moves. The movement of the inside is the same as the movement of the outside, and the movement of the outside is the same as the movement of the inside. When a globule of some kind changes its shape, this is the same thing as a change in the shape of the space that surrounds it. Only, we are brought up to believe that space isn't there and is an unimportant factor in the changes that go on among the solids in space. But this is why astronomers have such difficulty in communicating to the general public ideas that come under the heading of properties of space. Why? Because to the average person, space doesn't have any properties. Space is just what isn't there. But we know now that space isn't nothing. that it has properties, only they are not yet clearly understood. And when space may be said to be curved, and by its curvature influence the way in which light is propagated, or when you can consider space as a magnetic field, you begin to realize that there's something you've been ignoring all the time. It was, for example, perfectly a matter of common sense to Dante, and probably many of his contemporaries, to regard space and mind as the same thing. If you read a book called Saving the Appearances by a Britisher whose name momentarily escapes me, Behrensfield, I think that's it. B-A-R-E-N-S-F-I-E-L-D, Behrensfield. Saving the Appearances, anyway, that's the title. He has the most marvelous discussion of changing common senses. How different it would be to live in a world where everybody realizes that space is the mind, rather than our present superstition that the mind is something inside your head. When neurologists look for the soul somewhere in the brain, they can't find it because they're looking in the wrong place. The brain is in the soul. And the soul is not some kind of gaseous spook. The soul is the total arrangement and system of relationships constituting the universe, as picked up and transmitted by a brain. The brain, in other words, is some like a radio receiver. And it expresses in a highly complicated way the total configuration of all things that are. But in each brain, it does it slightly differently. So the soul, as you know, when astrologers drew a map of a person's soul, cast his horoscope, they drew, as nearly as they knew it, a picture of the universe as focused upon the time and place of that individual's birth. Well, that is a astrology, I think, is a highly unreliable science for practical affairs. But did express in a kind of mythological image, very beautifully, the truth that everyone is the cosmos centered in the place that you call here and now. But you see, when you don't know that, and you think that the external world is foreign to you, instead of being, as it were, your better half. I mean, imagine that. I know one difficulty that people have in assimilating this idea is that what happens to me when I'm unconscious? See, I go to sleep at night, and if I sleep soundly and don't have any dreams, I wake up at the same moment I went to sleep. You know, there just wasn't any interval, only I feel different when I wake up. Either I have a hangover or I feel refreshed. But the interim just wasn't there. And you think if it wasn't there, then... But there was I, open to everybody else's inspection, while I was lying in bed. Now, the same sort of situation bothers people about death. Because if you come to an end, and after death, there is unconsciousness. But you see, unconsciousness doesn't last any time. It may from somebody else's point of view. But actually, there is no such thing as experiencing being unconscious. But in the same way that you are unconscious of the way your, say, pituitary gland is functioning at this moment, or unconscious of the structure of small capillaries inside your body, and yet they're working, even though you don't know anything about it consciously. So in just exactly that way, your extended body, namely the cosmos, goes on when you're dead in the same way that your organic body goes on when you're asleep. And as when you wake up, your organic body restores its particular local consciousness. So after all of us die, the big organic body, which is the cosmos, waves lives somewhere else. And they are us. By us I mean the real self, the total cosmos, appearing all over again and becoming conscious once more. And when it happens, do you know what it'll feel like? It'll feel exactly like it felt when you were born. And whether you have, instead of eyes, long tentacles of some kind, or whether you have an antenna on top of your head or non-head, whether you have 100 legs or 2, you will see yourself as a human being. After all, mice and cats look human to each other. They think we look very odd. We're some kind of monster, because we're a different species. But all species look human to each other, because what the word human really means is the center place. Wherever anything looks out from is, from its point of view, the human place. And you must also be very respectful to creatures, because although you may think that they're not very cultured, they have a culture which is, from their standpoint, as refined as ours. They know, cats, for example, know that there are more and less refined cats. I've just been sitting on Henry Denison's patio listening to a mockingbird. And that thing has a tremendous culture. The things it can do with its voice. And there's no apparent reason for all that. It's just sitting there on the TV antenna, enjoying the afternoon. It doesn't seem to be a mating call, no mate comes around. It doesn't seem to be threatening anybody. It's just happy, and it's up there doing its stuff, and making this gorgeously complex music. And it's much more complex than we can hear. There are things in the qualities of the voice, subtle, tiny changes that are perfectly fascinating. This creature is unencumbered with clothes. We judge people's culture to such a large extent by their shopping. I was talking about that this morning, you know. By they go around and acquire things and have them all around, and that's the human way of showing off. But other creatures do it in a different way. They would, from their point of view, criticize us as being messy. as having all these things we have to dangle on ourselves and put on jewels and things and whatnot. And they would say, well, that's not... poor humans, they have to do that because they have such ugly bodies. They look like potatoes underneath their skins. And we have all these lovely feathers, and the fish have such beautiful colors on them, and they live in the water. One of the most intelligent creatures on earth is the dolphin. And the dolphin, many, many thousands of years ago, was a land animal. But when it saw what human beings were doing and the direction a high intelligence was taking on land, they all decided to go back into the water. Because in the water, there's plenty of food. You don't have to hunt too energetically. You're never liable to run into a famine. And you don't have to be encumbered with houses and clothes. And so you don't have to work. So dolphins spend most of their time playing. They like, for example, to pick up with a human ship. And then the ship makes a wake, and so they set their tail at an exact angle of 26.5 degrees or something. And the ship pushes them along. Well, they can actually swim faster than the ship goes, but they don't want to work. And they laugh, they play, they make circles around the ship, they do all sorts of things, because that's their way of life. And they're very, very sensible people. I've absolutely renounced eating dolphins because I feel it's cannibalism. The dolphin, in other words, knows how to get with it. And you see, this is the thing that these three religious approaches only find at the end of the line. Now, is it possible that there could be a new kind of religious approach in which heaven says to earth, I really do love you, with no ifs and buts? They say in Christianity, God so loved the world. But there's always a but after it. But the world has fallen away from God, and he loves it in the sense of a kindly but stern father who says, this is going to hurt me more than it's going to hurt you, and has this sort of, I don't know. The whole attitude, you see, is one of schism, schizophrenia, division between the spirit and the material. Would it not be possible for there to be a real reconciliation in which the spiritual and the material make friends and can say to each other genuinely, I love you with all my heart? And you see, this possibility emerges in the fourth way. And this fourth way, historically, is largely characteristic of Mahayana Buddhism. Because whereas in Theravada Buddhism, resignation is carried to its full limit, in Mahayana, what happens really is that when resignation has been carried to its extreme, and you find you can't resign from the game, because you are the game, and there's no you to get out of it, then you see this tends to happen automatically. So that the kind of personality called the bodhisattva emerges. That is to say, the one who doesn't go off into nirvana, but who comes back into the turmoil of everyday life out of compassion for all other beings and helps them to be liberated. But when they get liberated, you see, they in turn become bodhisattvas. Because there's always someone to liberate. Because while with one hand reality is realizing what it is, with the other it's forgetting. See? Like this. And three for a penny, three for a pound, is love that makes the world go round. And that's what happens. So this is constantly going on, just like you're eating and yet excreting, in-breathing, out-breathing, coming and going. Everybody is a whirlpool into which a great stream of milk and beer and beefsteaks and all sorts of things are flowing, and they swirl around like this and shoot out the other end. And that's like a whirlpool in water, you see. So everything is like that because existence is constituted by in and out. In alone doesn't make any do. Out alone doesn't make any do. But in and out together, they make a do. And so, much ado about nothing is a Buddhist conception of the cosmos. And that's marvelous, you see, because much ado would be better than nothing. Nothing all by itself, you see. You can't have nothing all by itself. You have to have something to have nothing, and as soon as you get nothing, you've got something. They go together in the same way. So, in this point of view, then, we are at peace in the middle of conflict. This is really the point from which I started in saying that from my point of view, there are no right religions and wrong religions. All of them are simply different, like different flowers. And one has certain preferences and tastes, one has one's favorite flowers, and the flowers one personally doesn't like. But the variety of them is necessary for every individual species. They all go together. Well, so in the same way, from this standpoint, you get this odd view of the world as fulfilled and completed, not sometime in the future, but now, here, today, with all its with all the things in it that appear from various points of view to be faults, sicknesses, peculiarities, and horrors. Now, I quoted this morning a child, a kid in a college, who said, "The thing I can't stand about college is that it's always preparing you for something to come. It never teaches you how to live now." You know that the poem called The Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, which is not really Omar, but Fitzgerald. It's an extremely free translation. But it carries the theme that we call carpe diem, seize the day. Drink, eat, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. And so, especially drink. Get roaring drunk, because the future has nothing in it for you. Actually, this poem is really mistranslated. You should read the translation by Winfield, which is quite a different matter. Omar Khayyam was a Sufi, that is to say, an Islamic mystic. And the Sufis had to keep quiet about their doctrine. The central doctrine of Sufism is An al-Haq. And that means, I am He. The realization, I am God. And so they say, just as there is no deity but He, so there is no heity but He. Well, many Sufis were tortured and slain because of the proclamation of the An al-Haq. So, they used hidden language to propagate their ideas. And in Sufi symbology, wine is the divinity. And to be drunk is to be enlightened, is to transcend oneself. And of course, this imagery is likewise in Christianity. That's one of the meanings of Holy Communion. Blood of Christ inebriate me, is one of the sayings in the, I think, the Divine Praises. And so the whole meaning of the Rubaiyat is get drunk today, because there is no tomorrow. Why is there no tomorrow? It is not because life is transient, not because we fall apart. We keep on falling apart. See, once you've fallen apart, you fall apart again. Everything is falling apart. It always has been. See, I mean, life is a process of everything falling apart. That makes multiplicity, many things. But the reason to get drunk today, because tomorrow we die, is that there is no such thing as tomorrow. There is only now. And if you don't do it now, you'll never do it. Because now is the only time it can be done in. So anybody who makes preparations for spiritual development and says, well, this is a tough and difficult road, and after many lives, I shall finally attain, you know what you're doing? You're playing games. You're postponing it. Because you don't really want to wake up. It's better to stay in the adventure, in the dream, in playing the role that you aren't you know who. Now you see how in this way I've mentioned in talking about repentance, how you can play with guilt. And I raised the question, what is the awful thing you've really done? And I showed you how the confessor, if he's a really smart confessor, will reject all your ordinary sins, all the murders and adulteries and all those things, and say, just small cheese. It's not just a piddling venial sins. But there is something awful, really awful, that everybody's done. What do you suppose it could be? Was it something I did in childhood and have forgotten? No. Something you're doing now, but have forgotten. See? Now, nobody can admit this sin, because if you admit having done it, you're immediately classified as insane. It's to say, uh-oh, I see what happened. I am the Supreme Self. Playing it isn't. And the reason for having a guilt feeling here is to keep the game going. There is this prohibition. You mustn't step beyond this mark. Don't do that. That's the deepest taboo we have.